Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Jeff White for a conversation on leading a combined schools and higher education group at scale. We'll explore the business model of independent schools and the business model of higher education and explore what it's like to lead both within the same group. Jeff is the group CEO of Advitech, an African education group listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, or JSE, with a market capitalization of approximately 18 billion rand, or roughly 1 billion US dollars. The group serves over 100,000 students across its schools and higher education institutions. Prior to joining Advitech in 2024, Jeff was the CEO of Nando's in Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. Jeff is a seasoned executive who has received a range of awards, such as being the Sunday Times South African Marketing Person of the Year and being a finalist for CNBC's African Business Leader of the Year. Jeff, it's lovely to have you here today. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Maybe as we start, I'd love to learn about you and your journey and your background. So maybe tell us a bit about where you grew up, a little bit about your family and your journey ultimately into education.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Scotland, in a variety of places, some very far north, not quite the end of the earth, but we used to joke that you could see the end of the earth from there. I have three brothers. My parents were academically inclined, so St. Andrews and Oxford, and then both of them went into teaching. My father ended up as a headmaster of a secondary school, and my mum was a French teacher and then went into guidance, so student welfare kind of area. I went to university in Aberdeen and started off on the advice of a careers advisor, doing maths, computing, and statistics, which I quite quickly worked out wasn't really what I was interested in. So segued into psychology and economics and ended up doing my degree in economics and then a master's in economics. I then went to London to work for ExxonMobil, first of all as an analyst looking after the petrol pricing for their UK business, which varies by petrol station. It's a lot simpler in South Africa. And then I went and ran...
In South Africa, the government just tells us.
That's exactly right. They have got an incredibly complex model that I used to manage. It was a spreadsheet that probably would paper the walls of this entire studio, managing the actual margin across the whole estate. And then I went and ran 30 petrol stations north of London, and then was promoted to regional operations manager, looking after about 700 petrol stations in London and East Anglia. That was an interesting time. The things that happen in petrol stations are varied and surprising sometimes. I remember there was one case where a pinstriped London gent went into a Maida Vale petrol station and said, "You appear to have a problem with your car wash." And we wandered outside, and the problem was that some local kids had tied bolts to the brushes of one of these brush car washes and had completely destroyed his Jaguar. So it was a remarkable understatement. So, but yeah, there were some interesting times there. I then went back to run convenience store marketing for Exxon's 3,000 petrol station shops in the UK. And It was at a time when the company was moving from, you know, workshops and car sales into convenience stores, bakeries, fresh goods. So it was quite a big change. So that was a lot of fun. I then left to go and work for PepsiCo, looking after their restaurant development planning for KFC, which was a brand that they'd acquired relatively recently and had been struggling to scale. So that was also an interesting experience. I went to be interviewed for a marketing manager job and ended up at the end of about 8 hours of interviewing with the whole UK board of PepsiCo asking me questions about restaurant development, which I thought was a bit odd. And then they came back, told me that was their biggest problem, and asked me if I'd come in and set up that function for them from scratch. So I quite liked the challenge, took it on, did that, took the system that we put together to a few international markets, and then went and did the marketing manager job that they'd employed me for. and then my first foray to South Africa, looking after marketing for KFC and Pizza Hut for their African business at the time. And there was a fairly big post-apartheid challenge where the franchisees had been given the business to run and had done all the things they'd always wanted to, but should never have been allowed to do. And the business was in a lot of trouble. So I spent a couple of years trying to fix that. And we did manage to turn that around quite nicely. Then I went back to London and worked in a business development role across Europe for PepsiCo, and then moved across to Unilever to head up their UK food service business. And shortly after that, Best Foods, the American conglomerate, were bought by Unilever. So I got some nice experience when they asked me to manage that integration of the UK businesses. And then at the end of that process, I moved to Holland, living in The Hague and working in Rotterdam for Unilever, running the European food service category. And whilst I was there, I had some contact from South African breweries, which was a little bit of a bolt from the blue, but I think they were aware of the work that I'd done on the KFC turnaround here. And they told me they were about to make a big acquisition and wondered if I'd like to come and help them with that. And that acquisition turned out to be Miller. So that was quite exciting. So I spent a bit of time in South Africa supporting the SA CEO and then a lot of time working on the marketing and strategy for Miller in the US and developing some campaign ideas there that took market share from Budweiser, which was also a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I then came back and looked after marketing, media, sponsorship in the SA business. And then after a couple of years doing that, I moved to be first marketing director for Southern and Eastern Africa for Cadbury Schweppes, and then commercial director for their Africa Middle East business. And then Kraft came along and bought Cadbury, and Cadbury were a really terrific company to work for. Great values, very high levels of competence in the business, and some great brands. But Kraft were not that. So I left to go and work for ABI. So I was managing director of the Snackworks business at ABI. Yes. So Baker's, Willard's, Pyatt's, those kind of brands. And then from there, I did some consulting and then worked in a boutique private equity firm for a while and was quite happy doing that, I must be honest. I mean, you know, there's obviously no work in private equity, as you know, Mondi. and then was persuaded to go and join Nando's, looking after their Southern Africa business initially, and then the larger region that you mentioned in your intro. And that had its challenges, especially through COVID, when you've got all the expenses of running a business and no income. I wouldn't want to do that again in a hurry. And then that very difficult period where we didn't have the vaccine in South Africa and people were dying. So I never want to go through that again. But, some great experience in a terrific company at Nando's. And then I think after 11 years with them, it was time for a change. And I was very attracted to the professionalism and business opportunity of Advatec and the fact that education is something that's quite dear to my heart. So I've been with Advatec for just over a year.
It's amazing, Jeff. You've written so many chapters in your book already. This is everything from petrol stations to chicken twice, both at KFC and at Nando's.
Yeah.
Pizza at Pizza Hut, beer at SAB Miller. And
all healthy stuff.
I may have contributed to some of the volumes there, some of your sales. It's extraordinary, just the range of businesses that you've been involved in over the course of your career. Mm. Maybe if I go back to right at the beginning, you started off with the fact that both your parents were teachers and you grew up in a family of four. It sounds like with three brothers.
Yes, that's right.
So where are you? Are you the oldest or youngest? Tell us a bit more about growing up with three brothers and what were your sports in the family?
Yeah. Second in line, I have an older brother who's chairman of a couple of oil companies. He had a very successful international career, including running Shell Brazil for a while. Okay. And I have two younger brothers, one of whom does top secret work for British Nuclear Fuels that he can't talk to me about. And my youngest brother, who works in IT, who's had a long career with the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh. So growing up, I mean, my dad was a big sportsman. He was an athlete and a rugby player, which is one of the reasons why I got involved in the South African Rugby Legends. But my dad actually played for Scotland, played on the wing in the 60s. And he scored the winning try against England in front of more than 100,000 in Edinburgh in 66 to beat England 6-3. So, I mean, I've had that dream a few times, but he lived it. So that was quite special. So rugby was a big thing. But I think I was a great disappointment to my father as a rugby player. Hopefully I didn't disappoint him in every way. But tennis, badminton, squash, racket sports, really my thing. I didn't really play a lot of golf in Scotland because it's one of the worst countries for wind and rain in the world. Yes. So mostly racket sports. My brothers, two of my brothers were very good rugby players, particularly my youngest brother, who played both my younger brothers played, I think, under 21s for Scotland at rugby. I have none of that talent, however.
Okay, got it. That's amazing as well. And Scotland is one of the most special places to watch rugby as well.
Yes, Murrayfield's quite special.
Exactly.
I think especially that enmity.
The flower of Scotland at the beginning. And it's amazing.
That enmity against the English is strong.
Shared here in South Africa.
Yes, I think that's one of the binding forces, Monty. I mean, you know, Flower of Scotland is all about a famous win in battle against the English.
Yes.
And I've theorized for years that if they played Flower of Scotland before the match and at halftime, Scotland would never lose.
I wouldn't go that far. Okay, and so you said rugby in the family, but tennis is your sport.
Tennis mostly,
I think you are involved still in tennis, so maybe tell us a bit more about that and that passion.
Yes, well, listen, I've enjoyed playing, and I think, you know, as part of trying to give back, I've been involved in the Tennis South Africa board for, I think, maybe the last 13, 14 years, and, you know, trying to steer the sport with minimal budgets in the best possible direction. So I try and make a difference there. And I mentioned in passing my involvement with the South African Rugby Legends, which was not such a long stint. But again, they do some really good work with youth development and help former players. And I think, you know, one of the challenges of being a professional rugby player particularly is it often robs you of the opportunity to study, and you make money and are famous and loved. Mm. And then at around 30, it all stops. And that's a very difficult transition, both financially and emotionally, for a lot of the players. So, but the South African Rugby Legends, which was founded by Gavin Origis, does a lot of great work in that area.
Okay, that's wonderful. And my last question then, just on you, before we get to some of the education-related matters. Mm. You've had a very varied career, both geographically, you've lived and worked in a lot of places, and then also in the nature of the work you've done. So I mentioned earlier, chicken, beer, you know, all sorts. So you could have lived anywhere in the world. Why have you chosen to be here in South Africa? And secondly, your motivation for more recently entering the education sector?
Yeah. I think I've either worked or had quite long exposure to lots of countries. And I think in terms of where I want to live, you know, that culture and values, I think are really important in that choice. I had some really interesting times between working in Moscow and working in Holland, and just the massive contrast there. I think both of those cultures can be quite hard. I wouldn't characterize the Dutch or the Russians as soft in any way, but I think you've got a very developed welfare state in Holland and pretty much nothing in Russia. And the outcome of that is the Russians look after a very extended group of family and friends, and the Dutch are all out for themselves because the state takes care of everyone else. So, you know, there are some really deep-seated cultural differences that I find fascinating. The Americans speak the same language, but do things in a very different way, I think, to the Brits and the South Africans. And I think there is a lot of commonality between South Africa and Scotland. You know, I think a focus on what's most important and very grounded. And I think, you know, we play the same sports and we've got the same ironic sense of humor. And I feel very at home here. So, but I'm fascinated by these cultural differences. But I feel very at home in South Africa, and I've really enjoyed the time here.
And we love living in London, by the way, except the Nando's has no spice in London.
Can we start about the differences between the UK Nando's and everywhere else? So I think the other thing that, you know, just looking back, when I first came here, I think it was 1998, and there was such a sense of opportunity and positivity and change. And I really felt, having, you know, really felt very anonymous in the UK, that I could maybe make a difference here. And that, I think some of that persists, maybe less so these days, but some of that persists. And again, that was an attractive feature of South Africa. I'm very glad I moved here, very glad that I stayed.
And the other part of that, the motivation for entering the education sector at this point in your life?
Yes. Listen, I think the family connection, I've always thought a lot about education and its power. Yeah, I think growing up in state schools in Scotland, it was mostly a reign of terror. So I think when you've experienced the good and the bad of education, you have a deep appreciation of how much of a positive difference it can make. And changing the course of people's lives. Yes. And it's great to be involved in a business that has that kind of impact.
That's wonderful. And the two themes you mentioned there, I'm a beneficiary of both. So the one, when you moved here in 1998, and the post-94 South Africa coming out of apartheid, and the optimism of the place and things, yes, getting better.
Yes.
I grew up in that. I mean, those were all part of my formative years. I was in primary school in all those years. And one of the lasting impacts that it's had is I generally expect things to get better.
Yes.
I grew up in a time where things were getting better. South Africa was getting better. You had, what is it, 70% of the population more or less locked out and coming into economic activity, educational opportunity, everything. So that's been formative in my life as well.
Yes.
And then your point on education. So you've got two teachers and a headmaster as a parent. My mother.
Your mum founded a school, didn't she?
Teacher,
yes,
exactly.
Amazing.
So I identify with a lot of what you said there.
Yes.
I appreciate you sharing that as well and going into your family.
Mm.
Let's move on then to some of the topics for discussion today in,
yes,
leading a combined schools and higher education group at scale. So perhaps to start, just give us a sense of the Advitech group. What are its divisions? What are some of its brands? What countries does it operate in?
Well, on the school side, we have just short of 120 schools in South Africa, Botswana, Kenya, and Ethiopia. The big brands are Crawford International, Trinity House, Pinnacle, Makini in Kenya. And the schools business is quite sizable. So revenue of about 3.6 billion and an operating profit.
3.6 billion, what currency?
In rands.
Rands, 3.6 billion rands.
And, yep, and about 800 million in operating profit on the school side. On the tertiary division, we have 34 campuses in South Africa, 60,000 students, actually just north of 60,000 on our latest results. Major brands, Varsity College, Vega, Rosebank College, Oxbridge Academy, and doing around 3.4 billion rand in annual turnover and making around 900 million a year in operating profit. And our tertiary business at the moment is only in South Africa, but in September we will open in Ghana with Rosebank University, which is exciting. And we also have a resourcing division which both does appointments and payroll management in several countries in Africa. The revenue there is about 1.5 billion. The margins are a bit lower, and it makes around 100 million rand in operating profit.
Okay, so this is a substantial human enterprise. I mean, over 100,000 students that you serve across these countries, South Africa, Botswana, Kenya, and excitingly soon to be Ghana.
Yep.
And then also a substantial commercial enterprise as well. With you quoted some of those revenue numbers across the varying divisions.
Yes.
I'm aware that education is the vast majority of the group and resourcing is a bit smaller.
Yes.
In there. And also, this is an education podcast, so I'll focus the conversation really on those
Makes
education
sense.
Segments, both the schools and the tertiary that you mentioned there as we go on. So you mentioned some brands both across schools and tertiary: Crawford, Varsity College, Rosebank College, McKinney, a range of brands. How wide is the range of price points that you serve across the group? And aside from fees, how do some of these brands differ?
Yeah, I think they flex in a few ways. There's definitely a divide between a very structured approach. So brands like Trinity House and Maragon are very structured. And then you've got a far more liberal environment in brands like Abbotts and Crawford. But that's a very definite split.
And just to make that tangible, so what would this be? Would my haircut be allowed in both, by the way, in Crawford and Trinity House? Or
come dressed as a pantomime cow at Crawford. That's really quite liberal. The rules are a bit stricter at Trinity House at Maragon. So, yeah, I think they would take an interest in your haircut, not so much at Crawford.
Okay,
it's very liberal. Price points, quite varied. I think if you look at the matric price point, that varies between around 90 at Pinnacle and 160,000 rand at Crawford. And our African schools probably at a slightly lower price point than Pinnacle, so maybe around 40,000 rand, depending on the exchange rate. And the flex in price point is around subject choice. So if you're going to offer a wide range of subjects and a wide range of extracurricular activities, there is a cost and an inherent inefficiency in that. And you'll have maximum choice at Crawford at quite a high price and a more restricted choice in the lower price brands. But what we try and deliver with consistency is excellence in whatever we offer. So we want the same level of academic outcomes and excellence on the sports and recreation side as well, but just with more limited choice. So they're probably the two big axes that we manage across.
That's great. I see a lot of variety there, both across the price points and in what you deliver, but all combined or united by academic excellence. What does that picture look like in the tertiary brands?
Well, we have two big brands, really. They're Varsity College Vega, which we look at as one entity, and then Rosebank at a lower price point. And the Rosebank fees range between about 16,000 rand a year and 50, but very affordable, even relative to the subsidized public universities. Varsity College Vega is more premium, focuses on honors degrees, higher degrees, and at a higher price point of between around 30,000 entry level and 140,000, so a different span. Rosebank is job focused, and it offers affordable ordinary degrees that allow students to transform their career prospects. Varsity College Vega, as I said, more premium with that slightly different slant of degrees and broader choice and a broader range of extracurricular activities on the campuses.
Okay. And across your schools and tertiary and those varying brands and price points, do you have a contact and a distance offering, or is it all contact?
We have contact and distance across pretty much all the courses that we offer. And we also offer blended options. So if you're a contact student, then you can do some of the modules via distance as opposed to physical lectures. So we try and make it as flexible for our students as we can. But we would categorize contact on the one side, distance on the other, and contact would have some flexibility online.
Okay, understood. And if you looked across the group as a whole, it is unusual to have, among the large groups, to have both schools and higher education together. What would you describe as sort of the glue that binds these, or the secret sauce?
You know, there are definitely some similarities between tertiary and schools. Both sectors are about strong brands. They're about academic outcomes. They're about enrollments. They're about data management. And I think to be successful, you need great systems in both to drive excellence in teaching and learning. So there are a lot of binding forces. Some differences. Schools generally are chosen by parents. Tertiary institutions are largely decided by the students. You get a different marketing challenge, a different target audience. Schools are location and enrollment constrained. They're usually in one physical location with physical boundaries. Universities can use multiple locations. So it's much easier to flex capacity, whether you're timetabling creatively or adding new buildings. And then the cycle is interesting. Schools have 12 or more grades to retain students. The university time cycles are typically shorter. So schools typically take longer to reach maturity, but they're more stable when you get there. And that's less so in tertiary, although tertiary generally, and it's not completely the case, but generally less CapEx intensive and generally higher margin than schools.
Okay, understood, understood. And one of the things from the outside that I've really admired in bringing these two together is what's referred to as the IIE, the Independent Institute of Education.
Yes.
Or Central Academic Team, I've heard it referred to differently. Yeah. Maybe just tell us a bit about that.
I think the Central Academic Team, let me talk about them first. That's a 160 strong group of people that develop courses, refine them, they support our teachers, they support our lecturers. They deal with the regulators, a number of very important functions. And I think the strength that we have there is a driver of academic superiority for us in both the tertiary and the schools divisions. So it's incredibly important to us.
All right. That's excellent, Jeff. And that's really the foundation for the excellent academic outcomes that are delivered across the group at Advitech. And, you know, in my view, that's the core of the educational product, is really delivering high quality outcomes.
Yes.
And happy students as well.
And I guess just maybe building on that, having both schools and tertiary in the same group gives us a huge amount of scale leverage. So, you know, leveraging procurement, finance, debt collection, and the Central Academic Team that we just spoke about are very powerful levers for us. We also are focused on being an employer of choice. Yes. And the size of that entity allows us to offer greater career options for our people, which is important. And when it comes to enrollment systems, customer relationship management, there's a lot of crossover. And there's also quite a high degree of synergy where you can link the schools to tertiary options. And we're working hard on realizing those.
Okay, that's brilliant. So clearly lots of value to being in a group here. It's diverse. There's lots of different brands at different price points and different propositions to students and families. And an excellent sort of support at the back through the Central Academic Team, and a great place for teachers to work.
Yeah.
So if I come then to the investor side of this, and it is the Education Investment Podcast. Advitech is publicly listed on the JSE. So our listeners, wherever they are around the world, can go buy a share.
Please do.
Or multiple shares. So how would you describe the investment case for Advitech?
Well, I think we operate in markets where you've got strong population growth, and failures in state education. I think, you know, the South African state education is not where it should be. And I think there are failures in some of the other countries that we operate in. So we have long-term tailwinds in both the schools and tertiary segments. So it's great to operate in a market that gives that kind of opportunity. And I think in that situation, our portfolio of strong, well-established brands, which also operate at high margin, which is particularly important, I think, in the African business, makes us very well positioned to catch our market opportunities. We also have a strong balance sheet. We generate a lot of cash. We've got that growing expertise and scale in African markets. And I think that all creates a long runway for profitable growth. And if you look at our compound annual growth rate in US dollars for the last 5 years, it's 15%. So I think we have a compelling business and lots of forward opportunity to build on the great base that we've created.
That's wonderful. And 15% compounded in US dollars for a business here in South Africa, earning a lot of revenue in rands and a few other countries in Kenya and shillings, et cetera, is a very exceptional outcome. The other thing that I took from there was there's still a lot of growth opportunity ahead as well in these various countries where you operate. So maybe just touch on that.
Yes, I think you've got fast population growth, high GDP growth, especially relative to South Africa. You've got shortfalls in state provision in both schools and tertiary. And, you know, that does create an opportunity for us to come in with all of our expertise and systems and really deliver a great product to a market that needs it at an affordable price point.
And the most recent announcement that I've seen from the group from a country expansion side, in addition to Ghana, which we've spoken about a little bit, is Ethiopia as well. And I'd love to hear a bit about that.
Yeah, so we've acquired five schools, the Flipper Group in Ethiopia, north of 3,000 students. And in a fast-growing economy with urbanization, high population growth happening at the same time, and a really exciting opportunity for us to grow significantly from the base of the acquisition that we've made. So I think Addis Ababa is the fifth fastest growing city in Africa. It's already got 6 million people. That's where the Flipper Schools Group is. So I think even if we don't go beyond Addis, that's a very attractive opportunity for us.
That's wonderful. And it is one of the biggest countries by population in Africa. That's wonderful to hear. And thanks for articulating that investment case. We mentioned that Advitech is publicly listed. And there are a lot of large school groups which are private, like Inspired and Nord Anglia and many other ISP, many others around the world that people will know about. So has Advitech as a listed business, has it been successful to public market investors? Do you feel it's achieved a good return and a fair multiple?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've delivered consistently good returns over a number of years. I think that performance wasn't really reflected in the share price until maybe 2 years ago. And I think there has been an adjustment there that I think was long overdue. I think we have to contend with negative sentiment when it comes to international investors around South Africa and Africa. But we just need to keep delivering great numbers, demonstrating that growth. I think we could also have done a slightly better job of communicating what is a great story. And, you know, if you've got a great story, you need to make sure you tell it as well. But I think generally, we've performed well as a stock. And I do think that there is significant upside given the trajectory of the business from here.
You know, I looked at this before we came together here today. If you look over the last two decades, so 2005 to 2024, which I chose those dates because they also coincide with Didier's tenure, the current CFO who's recently retired. And at your recent results presentation, you showed the development of the business over the two decades that he's been there, which I think was a lovely tribute. But if you look at the returns of Advitech over that two decades, I think it's been exceptional. The business has delivered, as a listed stock now, a 19x return to its investors in rands over two decades. And if you annualize that, that's an annualized return of 16.7%, so close to 17% annualized returns, consisting of both some share price appreciation and some dividends along the way as well. And that is way ahead of what the JSE has delivered. So it's funny sitting here listening to you as the CEO talking about the areas for improvement and the prospects going forward and all the forward areas. If we look back, it's been absolutely exceptional as a listed stock. And for an investor in education like me, it's really important because that it's positive for the sector as a whole to have a great success story that's reached scale and that has done very well for investors. So I'm really excited to hear that the prospects are even better. It sounds like looking forward. So there's been positive returns for investors. And we spoke a little bit about the other stakeholders as well, being an employer of choice and quality academic outcomes to the students. So how do you think about the social impact as a whole of Advitech and of independent education as a sector?
Well, I think we're fulfilling a deep societal need that isn't being met by the state. So if the private sector didn't exist in South Africa, huge numbers of kids would not be getting a tertiary education, for example. And I think the shortfall on the school side would be felt even more keenly than it is. In terms of the social impact, I mean, I think the one that really sticks out for me is we're able to offer degrees to the kids of families that have really come from humble beginnings and allow them to qualify as professionals and to really have a transformational effect on their lives. And I think we've been able to do that by leveraging our scale and leveraging that central academic team to offer really excellent quality degrees at very affordable prices. And I think of all of the areas that we're involved in, that one maybe has the biggest social impact. And I think the company as a whole is very proud of that.
That's wonderful, Jeff. And for our audience outside of South Africa, the gap that in tertiary that Jeff was alluding to is there are so many more applications, multiples more applications than there are spots in the South African tertiary education system. So that access is a problem. If I remember clearly, I think it was about 300,000 applicants at the University of Johannesburg for 10,000 first-year spots, something along those lines.
It's definitely a massive difference between supply and demand.
Exactly. And some of that will be accounted for by the fact that if I'm a student in matric, I will apply to multiple universities. So some will account for that. But even taking out that impact, there's still a massive lack of supply. And the other dynamic that's interesting there for me then, which I'd love to get your view on, is if we've got this big supply gap, the amount that needs to be invested in education is huge, and the state can't get there alone. You know, there are some estimates here. The World Bank and the Development of Bank of Southern Africa did a study a couple of years ago, and they estimated that just on education infrastructure, South Africa would need to spend about 2 trillion rand between now and 2030. So that's 5.5% of GDP per year between now and 2030 on education infrastructure. There's no way realistically that can happen. So you need the impact of the private sector. Now there's the private non-profit sector and there's the private commercial sector. And Advitech obviously falls in the private commercial sector. So how do you think about providing a reasonable return to investors in order to attract that capital?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we are trying to serve two masters. We're trying to perform a public service, but we're trying to do that in a commercially successful way. I think, you know, the fact that we spend hundreds of millions of rands every year on bursaries plays to the social impact side of things. From a commercial perspective, I think we've delivered, as you touched on earlier, some very strong returns for our investors. And I think we've done a pretty good job of balancing doing good for the country and doing well for our shareholders in a market where, and again, you touched on it, there is that big imbalance of supply and demand from the public sector.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think that's wonderfully summarized. It's both. It's you've got to have the returns, otherwise you can't get the private capital. And also you've got the social impact that you're delivering and the results speak for themselves. If I look forward then, Jeff, you said you were excited about the future. So tell me a little bit more about that. What's your vision? What are you excited about looking forward?
Well, when I joined the company, I wanted to have a very simple vision statement that we could focus around. And that was that we would lead in every segment that we choose to operate in. And for me, that's primarily about market share leadership. You can lead in several ways, but market share is the one that's most interesting. I think that that requires you to be focused and choiceful. And we've done a lot of work over the last year, particularly around our strategy, so that we can focus on the areas of greatest opportunity and our biggest strengths. And what's flowed from that process is significant areas of opportunity. So, you know, online tertiary, where we've grown well, but we have a relatively modest market share in the results just published. We talked about the fact that we've grown distance enrollments by 40% year on year. So the work that we're doing is beginning to pay off, but that's one area. I think leading in Africa and really working out what a winning proposition in the countries that we operate in there has been a big area of focus too. But again, I think we are moving that forward in the right direction. And And then I think on the second side of that, I think any business is a people business, but we are particularly a people business. Mm. And focusing on being an employer of choice is all about attracting, retaining, and engaging the best people. So I think if we can work out how to lead through winning propositions in all of the markets we choose to play in, and we can attract, retain, and motivate the best people, that's a winning formula. And I think if you can win in a growing market, the tailwinds that I spoke about earlier, the results can be spectacular. And that's definitely exciting.
That is very exciting. So a growing market and being a leader in each of the segments of that growing market where you choose to operate. I think that is a very compelling view forward. And as you know, I've been a big supporter of Advitech, and I will continue to be so, and supporting you along on this journey.
You've been a major component in driving our recent growth, for which we thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that. I'm going to come then from education and come back to you as we get to the end of the interview.
Yeah.
And I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests, and it's my favorite question. Yeah. And that's, please tell us about your favorite teacher or educator.
Yeah. Well, I touched on the reign of terror that was Scottish state education in the 80s earlier.
I couldn't tell if you were a perpetrator or a receiver of that terror.
I hope I wasn't any part of the terror. The terror really came from the schools. And when I think back to that environment, it felt like the teachers really didn't like the kids. I sometimes get emotional when I look at the level of care that my son has at St. Peter's here and think, God, that is a very different environment than the one I grew up in. And I think in the middle of that, I had a sports-obsessed business studies teacher who was very kind and supportive, a Mr. Doig. He was the deputy principal teacher of business studies. We called him Deputy Doig after the cartoon. I'm embarrassed to say I never knew his first name. It's always Mr. Doig, but he took a genuine interest and was always supportive, and that really made him stand out. And I actually heard that he died recently, but he was a good man and an empathetic oasis in a desert of indifference in my early school life that I'll always appreciate.
That's wonderful. It's a wonderful tribute to Mr. Doig and the amazing work that all of the teachers do. You come from two parents as teachers.
Yeah.
It's played a huge role in our lives, both of us sitting across the table here, and the amazing work that teachers do. Yes. So, Jeff, thank you. This was wonderful, learning about leading a combined schools and higher education group with you, and also learning about you. I learned some stuff that I didn't know today. So I had a lot of fun, and I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Yeah, a huge pleasure. Thanks, Monty.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.